You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Mark Gaber from the Campaign Legal Center. He'll be talking about the Utah Supreme Court's decision on Amendment D on Wednesday. Then Park City Councilmember Tana Tolle will have a recap of last night's discussion, which included a new bike and pedestrian plan. We're going to end the hour with Salt Lake Tribune Executive Editor Lauren Gustis. She'll be talking about the biggest stories over the past month. Getting into some local news now, a homicide investigation is in progress after a 61-year-old Wasatch County man was found dead at Jordanelle State Park. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
The man's body was discovered near the Ross Creek Day Use area at Jordanelle State Park Thursday. Sheriff Jared Bigby said the man's body was found lying next to his car on the shoulder of Shoreline Drive at about 11 a.m. One car door was open and its blinkers were on. The sheriff said a person passing through the area called 911 to alert law enforcement.
Our 911 center sent our deputies and medical here and found that there was a man that had passed away. They weren't able to do any work to resuscitate him. He'd been dead for an extended period of time.
Rigby said preliminary reports show the homicide was precipitated by a road rage incident. He said investigators believe the deceased man turned down Shoreline Drive about 11 p.m. Wednesday and was followed by another car.
We do have some video that we're reviewing. So it's from here in the area, and I think that tomorrow we'll be able to say with some more detail exactly where all that comes from.
He did not have a description of the suspect or the suspect's vehicle. Rigby did not give additional details about the video footage, but residents of the Deer Mountain neighborhood, which overlooks the reservoir, told KPCW police were knocking on doors looking for footage from security cameras that were pointed at the lake. One resident said an officer told him they were seeking the video as part of a homicide investigation. Rigby did not disclose the cause of death. He also did not disclose the man's identity, pending notification of his family. Multiple agencies were assisting Wasatch County with its investigation, including the Summit County Sheriff's Office, the Heber City Police Department, the Park City Police Department, Utah State Parks, and the Utah Attorney General's Office. The Ross Creek Day Use area is expected to reopen to the public Friday. Rigby offered his condolences to the man's family.
We're most concerned about the loved ones and the family that that are impacted by this, and our hearts go out to them. And we'll continue to be working with them, trying to provide resources and do whatever we can to help.
Bigby said there is no immediate threat to the public. He asked anyone with information about the incident to contact law enforcement. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
It's 8:12. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Good morning. Joining me over the phone now, I've got lawyer Mark Gaber with the Campaign Legal Center. How's it going, Mark?
Good morning, Parker. Great to be with you.
Yeah, well, obviously a major decision on Wednesday, but, you know, I think a handful of our listeners understand the context, but I think it's probably worth rewinding a little bit. So, I was kind of hoping you could provide us with kind of a brief history lesson between the 2018 initiative and kind of how we got to this courtroom on Wednesday.
Absolutely. So in 2018, a majority of the voters of Utah passed an initiative that would ban politicians from gerrymandering district boundaries in their favor, establish an independent commission to draw those and make recommendations to the legislature, and all around try to end the practice of gerrymandering in Utah. And that passed. And after that passed, the legislature was pretty unhappy about that because it would take the power away from them. So they repealed the law that was passed by the voters, and in its place had kind of a watered-down version of it, took away all the requirements that would apply to the legislature when it was actually deciding what the map would be, but kept in place a commission structure that was purely advisory. And then when the time came after the census to actually draw the maps, the commission did fantastic work, went around the state, collected feedback, followed the standards, and the legislature, you know, quickly just rejected everything they did and put in place one of the worst, with respect to the congressional map, one of the worst gerrymanders in the country that splits Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County into four pieces and ensures that the Republicans would have control of all the districts. So after that happened, on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Utah, Mormon Women for Ethical Government, and individual voters. We filed a lawsuit challenging those maps and also challenging the repeal of Proposition 4 as violating the Utah voters' right to alter or reform their government, which is in the first section of the Constitution and the Declaration of Rights that reserves that right to the people to alter and reform their government. And in July of this year, there was a major Supreme Court decision in our favor in the case that found that was a real substantial right, and that if the legislature was going to attempt to amend and certainly repeal a government reform initiative, it had a higher burden to meet. It had to show that there was a compelling government interest and that what it was passing was narrowly tailored in furtherance of that interest. So they can't just, with unfettered power, repeal citizen government reform initiatives. And after that happened, the legislature kind of went apoplectic and called in this emergency special set, called that an emergency, that the voters would have that fundamental right of protection, and had a special session and proposed this amendment that would undo the Supreme Court's decision and would give the legislature that unfettered power to repeal any citizen government reform initiative. and so that's what the amendment would do, it's Amendment D. But that's not, the legislature then gave itself the power to write the ballot language, and that's not what the ballot language says Amendment D would do. Instead, the ballot language said that it would strengthen the initiative process and would require the legislature to respect the intent of the initiatives. And so if you listen to anything I just said, describing everything up to this point about what the amendment would do and what the history of the case is, you'd be surprised if you saw that ballot language, because you'd think, wow, that's actually the opposite of what would happen if the amendment were adopted. And so that's what got us into the state Supreme Court this week.
Yeah, and I did, just before we move forward, I did want to mention that we at KPCW, we did invite both Senate President Stuart Adams and House Speaker Mike Schultz to join in on the conversation or through their representatives, but they did not respond to our request. So we were hoping to get both sides here. But I guess getting into the courtroom on Wednesday, you know, from your view, what was the argument coming from the other side, from the legislature side?
The legislature actually said that we should expect the legislature to put its thumb on the scale in favor of its argument. That's what legislatures do, they said. The other, which I was, you know, a little surprised by, and the justices, I think, were surprised by, because as Justice Peterson said, the history in Utah is that you get your ballot and you can trust that at the time you have your ballot, the campaigning is done. Like, your ballot is not campaigning at you. It's just telling you in a straight manner what will or won't happen if you vote yes or no. And so the legislature took a different view. They took the view that, you know, they're allowed to do a bit of campaigning on the ballot. The other issue in the case, of course, was that there's this plain text requirement in the Constitution that says if you want to amend this document, you need to give notice to the voters for a 2-month period by publishing it in newspapers. And so for whatever reason, the legislature just ignored that. They just didn't do that step. And so that was a big part of the discussion at the hearing this week as well.
And that's just a requirement that, you know, the language is posted verbatim in newspapers?
That's right.
And you know, I understand that may be coming up. I think we'll be talking about it later in the hour with the Salt Lake Tribune editor. But I know that's come up, I believe, in the Amendment A case as well. Can you talk about how that could implicate that?
Sure. The legislature didn't post any of the four amendments that are set to be on the ballot this year in newspapers for the 2-month period. So, you know, I think, I think we can kind of predict what will happen here. That there is a pending case with Amendment A. I believe the judge in that case said the Supreme Court's decision on the publication issue could resolve this. Mm-hmm. I think it's highly likely that the court in that case will rule that Amendment A is void as well. And if someone were to sue about Amendments B and C, I mean, I personally think the lieutenant governor getting this ruling from the Supreme Court has an obligation to pull all of them, to void all of them. But I think probably, you know, someone would need to sue over them.
Yeah. And getting back into the affairs on Wednesday, you know, what was your core argument? You know, what were you guys really pushing?
I mean, our argument was pretty simple, that the Constitution requires that the amendment or a fair and accurate description of it needs to be submitted to the voters, but the voters aren't responsible for distrusting the ballot and thinking, oh, I need to go, this might not be telling me what is actually going to happen. I need to go and figure it out myself. And so, and there's, that's consistent with how state Supreme Courts across the country have said that the ballot has to actually be truthful. Like, you're allowed to campaign, obviously, we expect that. We don't expect the ballot to be misleading us. And then with respect to the publication, that's just, you know, that's a straightforward plain text of the Constitution. So I didn't understand how the legislature could argue otherwise. And they really contorted themselves, in my view, into verbal gymnastics in trying to explain that the fact that there was newsworthy coverage of the dispute, like, that satisfied their obligation to cause the text to be published when, in fact, the text never was published, you know, until last week. So,
yeah, and so earlier this month, the district court ruled that the proposed ballot question for Amendment D was counterfactual and would make it impossible to have a fair election on the matter. Can you kind of talk about how the Supreme Court approaches a case like this, that, you know, there's already been a ruling on it on a lower court?
Sure. There's, you know, sort of two standards where it's a legal question. You know, did the district court get the law right? The Supreme Court takes a fresh look at that and doesn't really defer to what the district court did in that regard. In this case, where it comes to the district court's balancing of kind of the equitable considerations, like who's going to be harmed by an injunction, who's going to be benefited, where does the public interest lie, the Supreme Court will have a more deferential standard to the district court's weighing, because the district court was closer to the evidence in that regard. And so that's kind of the two-part standard that the Supreme Court will adopt when reviewing the district court's decision.
Yeah, and you know, during the special session and just kind of pitching this amendment when it first came out, you know, a lot of legislatures were talking about, understand there was kind of a foreign influence clause in there. And, you know, I think the other core argument was also, you know, the legislature should have the right to make some corrections to these ballot initiatives in order to make sure that they work effectively and efficiently. Was that a strong part of this case, or were kind of these other pieces overruling that?
I don't think that was a study. You know, on the first point, it's interesting, the ballot language pretty accurately described what would happen with the foreign influence piece, because that's what they thought would be the most appealing to voters. And they just glossed over entirely the fact that the main purpose of it was to allow for the legislature to repeal citizen initiatives and government reforms. And so, there's been this argument from the legislature and the press and certainly in the special session all along that this is important because, you know, initiatives will pass and we can't tweak the words, and there will be how we need to be able to make changes, as you said, to make them work more effectively. But the Supreme Court's decision earlier this year says the current Constitution allows them to do that. There's nothing that stops the legislature from making technical corrections, from doing things that make it work more efficiently or better. The only thing the legislature can't do under the current Constitution is repeal or make amendments that impede the purpose of the initiative. So they have to respect what the central thing is that the voters wanted to do in their reform. And as long as they're not hampering that, if they're making changes that advance that or just keep it kind of the same, they can do that. They just can't try to get rid of the reforms that the voters pass. And so a lot of the other thing is it's only about government reform initiatives. And so regular initiatives that regulate conduct as a law would that the legislature passes, that's not part of this. And so it really is a narrow constitutional protection that they want to throw out. And they're using these broad arguments that have nothing to do with it to kind of get public support behind it.
Yeah. Just going off the Salt Lake Tribune's reporting of the case, you know, they state that the Chief Justice of the Utah Supreme Court, Matthew Durant, kind of asked you if it would be enough to flood the airwaves with information around this amendment. And you said, you know, you didn't think that was enough. Can you kind of expand on that?
No, it really isn't, because really for two reasons. One is that that doesn't do anything to fix the ballot language. The Utah is a vote-by-mail state. 95% of voters get their ballot in the mail. They return them in the mail. That's all they're going to see. particularly because the state has the legislature passed a law no longer allowing the lieutenant governor to mail the voter information pamphlets that you used to get that had all the candidates and the positions for and against. You can only get that online now. And so the voter is just going to see the ballot. And so, and that language is deceiving. And so that's the main problem. The second is that this two-month requirement in the Constitution, this isn't like a technicality. That the idea was that the text of these amendments in the Constitution is dense, long. You want the voters to be able to have time to sit with it, to talk to their friends and neighbors and community leaders and go to public forum and debates. And, you know, even if folks don't do that, they ought to have the opportunity to do that. And so the idea that we could just fix this by in the next 2 weeks, having publication, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, and I also understand another justice asked you if they felt, you know, that it was constitutionally healthy for courts to invalidate elections. I assume they were referring to striking the amendment from the ballot. You know, what was your response to that?
Yeah, and Justice Pierce's question was actually about if we had brought the lawsuit after the fact.
Gotcha.
And the election had happened. And the idea was, well, maybe we should just make sure that, you know, the lack of notice didn't cause any real prejudice or harm to anyone. And so, you know, the response that I gave was, if after the fact there, you know, language wasn't misleading and it was just like they missed one of the county newspapers or for a couple of days or something, and it, then yeah, we want to be looking for ways to uphold the vote, but we're in such a different situation here that you know, particularly with this misleading ballot language, and since the election hasn't happened yet, let's not harm the voters. If the legislature wants to try this again, they can do it in 2026. They just have to follow the Constitution. Like, changing the Constitution is a serious thing, and the legislative process should be serious. They should involve the people. They should provide an opportunity for the people to comment. I mean, this was remarkable in August. The language wasn't released until late in the night before. They only allowed 3 citizens to speak in opposition, and they were each allotted 1 minute. So the legislature heard 3 minutes of public testimony in opposition to this. And so that's just not the process the Constitution envisions. And if they want to try to do this again, if they can muster, if at this point they can muster 2/3 support, I would hope that maybe some legislators had, once this has sat in, can see this isn't a good idea. But if they can get that support again and they can present it and they can publish it and we can follow the Constitution, that's how this election should happen.
Yeah, so the court issued their decision, you know, late Wednesday night, siding with you. How did you interpret their decision?
Well, it was they ruled in our favor on both grounds, that it wasn't, you know, that it was misleading and that it wasn't published properly. The court issued a very short order because we both sides asked that it just, you know, Supreme Court opinions are long and they're thoughtful and they're reasoned. We wanted to get an answer so that either the for or against campaigns could know what they need to do. So it's a short decision right now, but they ruled with us on both grounds, and I think correctly, and we'll get a longer opinion from the court in the coming months, and I think that will be important because that will set a standard for how this should happen going forward.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, KPCW did reach out to Senate President Stuart Adams and House Speaker Mike Schultz about joining in on this conversation to get their side. We did not receive a response, but they did issue a statement following the decision. They said that the court's actions is unprecedented and troubling, and they also said it's a sad day for Utah and voters, whether for or against the constitutional amendments. What's your reaction to that?
I kind of feel like I'm Alice in Wonderland. I just... blaming the court because the legislature didn't follow the plain text requirements in the Constitution and decided they were going to try to tell the voters the opposite of what would happen if they voted for this. I just, at some point, you got to just take personal responsibility and do better. Read the Constitution, do what it says, and be honest with the voters. That's not the court's fault. That's the legislature's fault, and they really ought to stop blaming the court.
Yeah, and so Amendment D will be voided from the ballot this November, but what's kind of the outlook for this situation going forward?
Well, I think that our case, our underlying case, which is about the redistricting, which is why we've gone so far afield so many times, The case about the gerrymandered maps is continuing in the district court. We've asked the court to rule that that map is unlawful, that Proposition 4 needs to govern it. We expect that proceeding to happen either, you know, late this year or early next, and hopefully we'll get an answer on that, and we'll get an answer on the maps. And as I said earlier, I hope that both that process and a more kind of honest and robust public conversation about the citizens' right to alter and reform their government and the importance of that, I hope that there can be kind of a calm and mature conversation about that realizes that that's not an emergency. That's actually something that has existed since 1895 in the Utah Constitution, and it's there for a reason. And we oughtn't change it in such an abrupt manner like this.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I'm about out of time, but is there anything else you want to mention?
No, I'm just grateful for all of the public attention to this over the past month. I think it's really gone a long way to educate folks, and you know, hopefully this is the last time that you see ballot questions that aren't, you know, honest with you. I hope that we've learned a lesson here.
Yeah, well, we really appreciate you calling in and sharing your side.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, have a good one. It's 8:31. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Jumping back to some local news stories, Dakota Pacific Real Estate is asking Summit County for more housing density in its revised Kimball Junction development plan. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it wants to concentrate open space closer to the rest of Kimball.
The Salt Lake City-based developer would like to build at least 750 housing units on its land in Kimball Junction near the Skull Candy headquarters. That number comes 5 months after Dakota Pacific last floated a housing proposal. It owns some 50 empty acres, some of the last developable land in the Snyderville Basin. The developer has come to the Summit County Council with at least four different housing plans since applying to build in 2019. The back-and-forth negotiations were paused in April to work on a public-private partnership and closed-door subcommittee. That subcommittee debuted a master plan for a new plaza and transit center along State Route 224 last week. At Wednesday's county council meeting, the public saw how the public-private partnership plans would gel with the rest of Dakota Pacific's proposal. The partnership parcel is closest to State Route 224. It would include 167 county-owned affordable housing units, new civic buildings, and an expanded transit center. Further west, Dakota Pacific would build 750 units, a third of them for lower-income earners, explains Director of Commercial Development Steve Borup.
And we've purposely moved a lot of the open spaces that we're investing in to, you know, this east side so that it's not just about neighborhood open spaces that the residents of this neighborhood enjoy and appreciate, but it's a broader community destination for Summit County.
The open space would surround a new library and county offices at the Skull Candy building, which Summit County purchased in May. Behind Skull Candy is an Olympic view area with sight lines of the Utah Olympic Park. The total residential density would be 917 units. That's a couple hundred more than Dakota Pacific was asking for in April, but hundreds less than in 2019. The proposed density could change yet again over the next few months. Dakota Pacific needs the council's permission to build any housing because the area currently allows for tech offices similar to the existing Skull Candy building. Council members have insisted on negotiating in public and requested less housing. A potential assisted living facility has featured in past discussions too. And now Borup says Dakota Pacific is pursuing it with renewed interest since Oakley's Elk Meadows, the only assisted living facility in Summit County, may close.
And I'm working with operators to try to work through the viability on that.
A 90-unit assisted living facility isn't factored into the rest of the residential density measurements. It's being counted as commercial because of the business license it would need. The council is planning to negotiate weekly during its Wednesday meetings to arrive at a decision before 2025. More information, including the latest diagrams and site plans, is at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Good morning. It's 8:34. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. In studio with me now, I've got Park City Council Member Tana Tolley. How's it going this morning?
Good morning, Parker. It's great. How are you?
I'm great. It's Friday. I'm in a good mood.
Me too. And the colors are absolutely gorgeous.
They're popping. The aspens are really starting to turn that, you know, kind of that sparkle yellow.
We were popping at council last night.
I guess getting into council, maybe we can start with some of the more boring stuff maybe, but the council did approve a $1.5 million contract to replace that retaining wall right next to City Hall. Did you want to speak on that and what?
Yeah, sure. So this wall that's part of the parking structure here and the retaining wall does need some emergency repairs. And so it's come to council to get those fixed as quickly as possible. We did ask to come back and have an overall discussion of what the overall repairs look like to this entire parking structure. Mm-hmm. As you know, part of it has been here for quite some time. And then another part of it is actually new. So we'll just be continuing to monitor that, but we did just want to make sure that the retaining wall itself is able to withstand any additional movement or anything like that before we go into this winter.
Yeah. Well, kind of more exciting, bike and pedestrian plan. So this was presented and approved last night, kind of not specifically approving any projects, but it kind of has this broad framework for kind of looking forward and where the city should prioritize connections and other improvements. You know, what do you see in there that pops out to you?
Yeah, so this is our 10-year plan of bike and pedestrian, and we've had a great stakeholder group that included a couple members of our council, Councillor Rebel and Sirocco, as well as two members of our planning commission. And they just went through looking at capital project prioritization, public policy, and just different areas of town where we see the need to continue to make sure that we're safe in crossing for pedestrians and for bikes. So some of the things, one of the ones I brought up was a connection at Richardson Flat where you're connecting from the rail trail over to, if you're going up to Round Valley. And right now, you know, there's a crosswalk there, but what else could we add to ensure that people feel safe when they're crossing there? More in town, there's going to be a couple that will actually go into the Main Street plan as well. Mm-hmm. Things down by like the Y where you're turning in here to come to Main Street. There's looking at the Bonanza Crossing where we have the flags. So it's anywhere that you would cross in Park City and be up against vehicles that might be going a little bit faster than you're happy with trying to cross there. So there's two parts of this. There's the High Comfort Network and then there's a secondary network. But this just really wants to ensure that bicyclists and pedestrians of all ages and abilities and mobility are able to cross and feel safe in doing so.
Yeah, and I understand it's also a pretty big step for just securing grant funding for such projects.
Yeah, absolutely. This does help us go after federal funding, but it is, you know, our 10-year plan. If you are interested, you can look on our website at the maps. It's quite fascinating to mm-hmm. see where all these crossings are, and I think that it gives people an idea of, you know, how important pedestrian and bicycle safety is in Park City, as well as, you know, the other things we talk about, like buses and traffic and parking and all of that. So it all comes together, but you know, the council's priority is always to ensure that we feel that pedestrians are safe when they're out there.
Yeah, you've been around here for a while. How do you feel like the city's infrastructure in that realm has improved over the years?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a kid, there were like maybe two mountain bike trails here. I mean, summer in Park City was not that great. And now, I mean, we've done such an amazing job in having and partnering with our mountain trails and creating robust mountain bike trails. And then this is just another layer to that where we're creating more trails that connect to one another, but throughout our town. And I think, you know, it would be great if you lived in Upper Park Meadows and are able to get to Main Street without feeling like you have to cross a road mm-hmm. That might not have a crosswalk or a light or any sort of signage. But that's the whole goal. And my whole goal, even when I ran for council a few years ago, was that we need to be more connected. And so what does that look like, you know, literally and figuratively, and how do we ensure that these different areas of our town are connected through bike trails as well as through connection sources of shuttles and getting people in and out. But just feeling like an overall holistic plan for this town is something that we need, and that always includes bicycle and pedestrian safety.
Yeah, moving on. You know, historically, there's been a lot of pickleball players that have showed up at council meetings, you know, with a lot of strong opinions about how courts were being managed. Kind of turned yesterday. There was a lot more tennis players there unhappy with the proposed setup for the Mark this winter. Can you kind of just explain where we're at on this topic?
Certainly. I am not sure if you know this, but the most emails I've ever received in my life are about pickleball. So it has been quite the robust conversation, and council gave, you know, the direction to our RAB board to take a take a few months, and actually they took 6 months, and create a subcommittee of the RAB board to look at tennis times and to look at pickleball times and see if there was any room for movement. And this, I want to be clear, is regarding the winter time frame. So we do have the bubble that just went up. And so what they have decided to do, and I want to be clear too, our team has worked really hard on this, and I do respect what the RAB board has done, because we do entrust them with coming to council with decisions. Whether or not we always agree, we do entrust them to do that. So we did have a lot of tennis players come out yesterday and speak. We also received many, many emails, and I don't think that this conversation is in any way over. It needs to be a continued conversation. But what we did discover is that they're going to add 84 additional, I want to make sure I say this correctly. Yeah. So yeah, there's 84 additional hours throughout the week. So that's things like Mondays and Wednesdays, there will be pickleball time from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. in the bubble. They've added afternoon hours of 2:30 to 4:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then there's a few others that will be posted at the mark. But overall, the idea was that tennis will continue to have access to the bubble outside of the hours that are indicated. And then tennis and pickleball will continue to be scheduled separately with no side-by-side play. And then if pickleball is not taking those court times, then tennis can come in and take those. So I do encourage people. I know this conversation is a really tough one, and we're trying to balance the needs of the pickleball community and the tennis community in what has been historically a tennis facility. So I do encourage people to continue to talk to the RAB board. That's the first place to really give input and say, this is affecting me in these ways. We heard from a lady last night who said, you know, she's for 3 or 4 years been playing at 9 a.m. every single Monday, and this now will affect her group of 12 people. So we just want to make sure that the people's voices are heard. So, you know, please speak to the RAB board, and also always you can speak to council.
Yeah. Well, moving on, you know, I think it was a few weeks ago you gave an update to the council just on legislative affairs. You know, we've got the upcoming Utah legislative session that begins in January. I believe if I remember correctly, you're talking a lot about housing production and how that, you know, they really just want to build units. You know, what can you tell us about what you've learned?
Yes, absolutely. So I am honored to be selected to serve on the Utah Leagues of Cities and Towns board. We haven't had someone from the Wasatch back since 2021, I want to say. So this is giving us an opportunity as the Wasatch back to have some representation along with the other cities and towns of Utah. So I will be spending quite a bit of time down with this group and at the state legislature working on issues that are going to affect our town. And yeah, the big words, the buzzwords are always housing. And what we're hearing a lot of is parking reduction and centralized parking, and how do we take these primarily asphalt parts of our town and create more housing. That's been a big topic that we keep hearing of. You know, a few years ago it was water, now it's become housing. And the governor speaks all the time about creating housing for our grandchildren, and how do we do that as a city, as cities. I will say the Leagues of Cities and Towns, though, has entitled thousands and thousands of units of affordable housing, all types of housing, and it's just getting these built and encouraging more people to be able to stay in their towns and their cities. So we'll hear more about that, and I will be happy to continue to give you updates, and then I'll give updates at the council as well. But we're really excited about this opportunity.
Yeah, and a few weeks ago, big step for the city issuing a request for proposals for the Bonanza Park 5-acre area. Can you talk about your participation in that process and just how you feel about it going forward?
Well, it's very exciting. We are now at this point where an RFP was sent out, and I believe it closes the first week of November. We're doing a very robust search throughout the country to find different partners who will come and work with us on this. This is a huge project for the city. We know that. We know we've been working on it for a good 7 years, and we're just excited to see what comes back to us and then start creating a more local-centric area there that also does have great connectivity to Main Street and great connectivity to the resorts, and really just takes us into the next era of Park City. And I know everyone wants to see something there, so this is just the first step in that process, and we will continue to keep moving forward. But we're all very excited that the council was able to come to an agreement on what we wanted to see, and then we're excited to see what the developers will bring back to us.
Yeah, and just to give a rehash, you know, what were kind of those core pieces that the council would like
to
see?
Yeah, so one of those would be the centralized parking, but having it underground. We don't want to have surface parking in this area. We did want to see quite a bit of open space in there, but also this is a mixed-use space, so that includes commercial, some smaller commercial. It also will include some art components to it, and it does include a space for the Kimball Art Center, and then it will also include a little bit of housing as well. So we'll see we don't know exactly what the percentages of each of those are, but the developer does have the platform to come back to us, and then we will negotiate and work through those details. But those were the big things that we'll see there.
Yeah, and then, you know, just finally, the local law enforcement agencies kind of held an emergency training session on Tuesday. I got to witness some of it, but I understand you also kind of participated. What'd you learn?
Yeah, I did with Mayor Worrell. We had a great time. Every year, the city works on this emergency management exercise, and this year it was managed primarily from the county perspective. Last year, the city took the lead, but it's just a great opportunity for all of these agencies to come together and really go through what it would look like if we had a full-scale emergency, and what would we be doing, and where would council fit into this, and who's in charge, and just making sure that all of those kinks are worked out so that we're continuing to protect our residents and our visitors. And it was a fascinating one to have something that was they had said it was like a radioactive bomb, and you're thinking in your mind, I don't even think I've ever thought of a radioactive bomb going off here. You know, you think of emergencies of things more like fires and floods. But to think that something in our air could affect our residents, how would you get people out of here so quickly? So that was a wonderful wonderful work that we did as county and city together, and I'm always a fan of us working in those conjunctions.
Yeah, and just lastly, just want to touch on the Main Street water line construction. As a Main Street business owner, are you supportive of that expedited timeline to get it rolling again?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't say it's from a Main Street business owner. I take very seriously what the HPCA said to us, and they actually went out and did a survey of the business owners, and I think it was like 65 to 68% of the business owners above the post office were in favor of this plan. So, of course, that was where my decision-making came from on that.
All right. Tana, anything else you want to mention?
You know, I just wanted to mention we did get a proclamation of it being Domestic Violence Awareness Month for the month of October, and I think this is such an important topic that we continue to talk about, and I was just shocked that 1 in 3 women and 1 in 5 men in Utah are involved in some sort of domestic violence in their lifetime, and it just breaks my heart to hear these statistics. So I just encourage people to find out more of how they can help and be a part of this.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Park City Council Member Tana Tolley about last night's meeting. Thanks for coming on, Tana.
Thank you, Parker. Have an awesome day.
You too. Be right back with Salt Lake Tribune editor Lauren Gustis. Good morning. It's 8:49. I'm KPCW's Parker Malatesta. You're listening to the Local News Hour. On the phone with me now, I've got Salt Lake Tribune editor Lauren Gustis. How's it going, Lauren?
Not bad. How are you, Parker?
I'm pretty good. You know, we spoke earlier this morning with attorney Mark Gaber, who represented the plaintiffs in the Amendment D case. You know, he talked a lot about the newspaper requirements and kind of the other nuances of the case that the Utah Supreme Court upheld that lower court decision. We wanted to get in a little bit into Amendment A, I was hoping you could talk about what that is, but then also the status of that amendment potentially being on the ballot this fall.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not just D that is being reconsidered or that has been reconsidered. Amendment A would reframe how the legislature is allowed to use income tax revenue. So right now, income tax revenue can be used for public education, so all your public schools up in Park City, higher education, and services for children and people with disabilities. And that revenue is not insignificant. It is estimated to be $8.4 billion next year, right? But it can't be used on anything else. And there's a big bucket of money sloshing around that lawmakers haven't allocated to higher ed, to public education, or to kids and people with disabilities. So lawmakers would like to use that money for other purposes. They haven't said what, but they have said that there are state needs, and I'm doing air quotes there, that they would like to allocate this money towards. So they put Amendment A on the ballot, and that would allow them to do that. They've added a sweetener, which is Amendment B. Amendment B would eliminate your state grocery tax if A is passed. So it's an incentive, in a sense, for people to vote for A. But the Utah group of teachers, the UEA, they're called the Utah Education Association, has come out against Amendment A, which is not surprising, of course. But they piggybacked on the lawsuit that was filed on Amendment D on the same grounds, which is that A, the amendment is misleading, and B, that it wasn't placed as it should have been in newspapers across the state 2 months before ballots are mailed, 2 months before the election, right? And so Amendment A opponents are hoping for the same outcome that the Amendment D opponents got this week when the Supreme Court said, no, Amendment D is void. So they're asking for Amendment A, and then by extension, Amendment B, to be voided. A judge has not determined when this will be heard. And as you know, Parker, ballots are mailed here in just a couple of weeks. The Amendment A and B descriptions are still going to be on our ballots, just as Amendment D is still going to be on our ballot. But the question is, will those votes be counted?
Yeah, no, that'll be one to watch. You know, wanted to mention, I understand Tribune reporter Leah Larson is taking part in this local investigations partnership with the New York Times. Could you talk about that partnership, but then also her recent reporting on some tree removal in, I believe it was Eastern Utah?
Yeah, so the New York Times has this program in which they welcome fellows from all over the country for a year to work on local investigations. And Leah applied last year. She was admitted, so she's been working with editors at the New York Times and reporters from across the state since about April or so. It's just a great opportunity for her, and it's a great opportunity for us. And one of the things she wanted to focus on is the intersection of politics and environmental issues, which, as you know, Parker, here in Utah is quite thick, right? Yeah. And so she wrote earlier this month about an individual, and this is where radio really comes in handy, and me being a words journalist, I can get stopped up. Mike Ciaparis, I think is how you say his last name. He's a software executive. He's lived here in Utah for a while. I mean, he has this big ranch in Eastern Utah, and he wanted to see the wildlife in front of him. So he started to bulldoze swaths of trees on his property. The state was interested in what he was doing, how he was cutting these trees down. He is employing a process called roller felling, in which you essentially take a big, long, strong wire, right, and roll it across a bunch of trees and take them out all at once, which is, how do I want to say this? Some academics and environmentalists are skeptical of that process, but at the end of the day, before lawmakers got involved, his land, his choice, lawmakers have given Ciaparis more than $5 million to do this roller felling in Utah, mostly on his land, right? But the question is, should we be spending as taxpayers money on private property to take trees down so that there's more opportunity to see wildlife, there's more opportunity to hunt? He's got a pretty fancy resort on the property, welcomes people to the property for all kinds of outdoor pursuits, and Utah taxpayers are footing the bill. So Leah wrote this story, she's got more to come, but I think, you know, it's a fair question to ask, okay, where is our money going, and how might we take a closer look at how we're spending money in the environmental space as it pertains to, you know, the allegations that our lawmakers are making every year.
Yeah, moving on, the Trib had a nice scoop recently about Black Desert Resort in Evans. They're looking to build an arena that could potentially host minor league hockey or NBA preseason. And so I guess there's a bill being written for next legislative session asking the state to help fund this project, which could cost around $2 billion. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so just to back up a minute, Ivins is right next to St. George down in Washington County, and it's building, it's okayed this ginormous resort, more than 3,000 rooms, really beautiful golf course in, you know, black lava. It's going to host a PGA, an LPGA tour event within the next calendar year. And, you know, to some degree, Black Desert sees itself as an alternative to Park City. Obviously, the climates are very different, but it's another essentially luxury destination here in Utah. And the developer of Black Desert is interested in putting an arena down there. I think Ivins' population is somewhere around 9,000 people, so it's not that big, just growing. And the arena, hypothetically, would seat anywhere from 5,000 to 12,000 people, according to Patrick Manning, who's the developer of this project. It's developed many other places, including, I think, Marcella up your way. Yeah. Anyways, as you know, as your readers and listeners probably know, taxpayers are engaged in arena projects down in Salt Lake City, both the rehabilitation of the NHL and NBA arena and entertainment district, right? And right downtown, and then potentially an MLB stadium. And so this would be essentially a third ask for public funds to support a stadium that would be built down in, this time, southern Utah, but again, with public money, with support. There is a lawmaker, Jerry Stevenson, who said he would carry it. Although in our reporting, he didn't sound all that confident that it would pass. He said, even if it passes, it's quite a ways out. My gosh, $2 billion. I don't know if, you know, that's how much money we should be spending on a project like this. There's a lot of conjecture still about what they can put together. But we've let people know it's out there now in the public domain, the public realm, and we can have a conversation about it.
Yeah. Lauren, I'm about running out of time, but I did briefly want to touch on, I understand you guys recently did a piece on what the Ute Tribe gets in exchange for letting the University of Utah use its name.
Yeah, so the Ute Tribe is one of the few tribes across the country that lets a university use, you know, its name and its likeness. And Courtney Tanner, one of our reporters, longtime Tribune reporters, took a deep dive into what the Utes get. And she found that the U doesn't formally track enrollment of Ute students, that even as Ute students are supposed to receive benefits, including scholarships, there are no minimums for the number of scholarships. The scholarships that are provided don't actually cover the cost of tuition. And there are no mandates for monitoring their progress if and when they do arrive on campus. So all in all, the findings are, you know, it'd be great to support these Ute students, which per the agreement with the Ute Tribe should be getting a benefit from the university as they look to go to the college and as they look to move through their college experience successfully.
Yeah. Well, as always, you can get all your content on sltrib.com. Appreciate you joining us this morning, Lauren.
Of course. Have a great day.
You too. Bye. Bye. It's 8:59 now. You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. Appreciate you tuning in this morning. Some final news on the way out. Park City Mountain owner Vail Resorts told investors Thursday during an earnings call that it plans to cut 14% of its corporate workforce as part of a two-year plan to save $100 million in operating costs. In total, Vail is cutting 2% of its total workforce, which spans across 42 resorts in North America, Australia, and Europe. The Broomfield, Colorado-based company said less than 1% of frontline roles will be eliminated. According to a recent tax filing, Vail employs around 7,600 year-round staff. The job cuts follow a winter season in which skier visits to Vail's properties declined over 9% compared to the prior year. Epic Pass sales for the upcoming winter are also down about 3%. It's 9 o'clock. I'm going to send you over to NPR News here now. Stay tuned for Fresh Tracks Friday. We'll be dropping new music at the top of every hour. I'm KPCW's Parker Malatesta. Thanks for tuning in this morning.